Chapter 29. The two bedchambers, Hetty and Dinah both slept in the second story, in rooms adjoining each other, meagerly furnished rooms, with no blinds to shut out the light, which was now beginning to gather new strength from the rising of the moon, more than enough strength to enable Hetty to move about and undress with perfect comfort. She could see quite well the pegs in the old painted linen press on which she hung her hat and gown. She could see the head of every pin on her red cloth pin cushion. She could see a reflection of herself in the old-fashioned looking glass, quite as distinct as was needful, considering that she had only to brush her hair and put on her nightcap. A queer old-looking glass. Hetty got into an ill temper with it almost every time she dressed. It had been considered a handsome glass in its day, and had probably been bought into the Poyser family a quarter of a century before, at a sale of genteel household furniture. Even now an auctioneer could say something for it. It had a great deal of tarnished gilding about it. It had a firm mahogany base, well supplied with drawers, which opened with a decided jerk, and sent the contents leaping out from the farthest corners, without giving you the trouble of reaching them. Above all, it had a brass candle socket on each side, which would give it an aristocratic air to the very last. But Hetty objected to it, because it had numerous dim blotches sprinkled over the mirror, which no rubbing would remove, and because, instead of swinging backwards and forwards, it was fixed in an upright position, so that she could only get one good view of her head and neck, and that was to be had only by sitting down on a low chair before her dressing table. And the dressing table was no dressing table at all, but a small old chest of drawers, the most awkward thing in the world to sit down before, for the big brass handles quite hurt her knees, and she couldn't get near the glass at all comfortably. But devout worshippers never allow inconveniences to prevent them from performing their religious rites, and Hetty this evening was more bent on her peculiar form of worship than usual. Having taken off her gown and white kerchief, she drew a key from the large pocket that hung outside her petticoat, and, unlocking one of the lower drawers in the chest, reached from it two short bits of wax candle secretly bought at Treddleston, and stuck them in the two brass sockets. Then she drew forth a bundle of matches, and lighted the candles, and last of all, a small red frame shilling-looking glass, without blotches. It was into this small glass that she chose to look first after seating herself. She looked into it, smiling and turning her head on one side, for a minute, then laid it down, and took out her brush and comb from an upper drawer. She was going to let down her hair, and make herself look like that picture of a lady in Miss Lydia Donathan's dressing room. It was soon done, and the dark hyacinthine curves fell on her neck. It was not heavy, massive, merely rippling hair, but soft and silken, running at every opportunity in two delicate rings. But she pushed it all backward to look like the picture, and form a dark curtain, throwing into relief her round white neck. Then she put down her brush and comb and looked at herself, folding her arms before her, still like the picture. Even the old model glass couldn't help sending back a lovely image, nonetheless lovely, because Hetty's stays were not of white satin such as I feel sure heroines must generally wear, but of a dark greenish cotton texture. Oh yes. She was very pretty. Captain Donathan thought so. Prettier than anybody about Hayslip, prettier than any of the ladies as he had ever seen visiting at the Chase. Indeed, it seemed fine ladies were rather old and ugly and prettier than Miss Bacon, the miller's daughter, who was called the Beauty of Treddleston. And Hetty looked at herself tonight with quite a different sensation from what she had ever felt before. There was an invisible spectator whose eye rested on her like morning on the flowers. His soft voice was saying over and over again those pretty things as he had heard in the wood. His arm was round her, and the delicate rose scent of his hair was with her still. The vainest woman is never thoroughly conscious of her own beauty till she is loved by the man who sets her own passion vibrating in return. But Hetty seemed to have made up her mind that something was wanting, for she got up and reached an old black lace scarf out of the linen press, and a pair of large earrings out of the sacred drawer from which she had taken her candles. It was an old scarf, full of rents, but it would make a becoming border round her shoulders, and set off the whiteness of her upper arm. And she would take out the little earrings she had in her ears. Oh, how her aunt had scolded her for having her ears bored, and put in those large ones. They were but colored glass and gilding, but if you didn't know what they were made of, they looked just as well as what the ladies wore. And so she sat down again, with the large earrings in her ears, and the black lace scarf adjusted round her shoulders. She looked down at her arms. No arms could be prettier. Down to a little way below the elbow they were white and plump, and dimpled to match her cheeks. But towards the wrist, she thought with vexation, that they were coarsened by butter making, and other work, that ladies never did. Captain Donathan couldn't like her to go on doing work. He would like to see her in nice clothes, and thin shoes, and white stockings, perhaps with silk clocks to them, for he must love her very much. No one else had ever put his arm round her, and kissed her in that way. He would want to marry her, and make a lady of her. She could hardly dare to shape the thought, yet how else could it be? Marry her quite secretly, as Mr. James, the doctor's assistant, married the doctor's niece, and nobody ever found it out for a long while after, and then it was of no use to be angry. The doctor had told her aunt all about it in Eddie's hearing. She didn't know how it would be, but it was quite plain the old squire could never be told anything about it, for Eddie was ready to faint with awe and fright if she came across him at the chase. He might have been earthborn, for what she knew. It had never entered her mind that he had been young like other men. He had always been the old squire at whom everybody was frightened. Oh, it was impossible to think how it would be. But Captain Donathan would know. He was a great gentleman, and could have his way in everything, and could buy everything he liked. And nothing could be as it had been again. Perhaps someday she should be a grand lady, and ride in her coach, and dress for dinner in a brocaded silk, with feathers in her hair, and her dress sweeping the ground, like Miss Lydia and Lady Daisy, when she saw them going into the dining room one evening as she peeped through the little round window in the lobby. Only she should not be old and ugly like Miss Lydia, or all the same thickness like Lady Daisy, but very pretty, with her hair, done in a great many different ways, and sometimes in a pink dress, and sometimes in a white one. She didn't know which she liked best, and Mary Birch, and everybody would perhaps see her going out in her carriage, or rather, they would hear of it. It was impossible to imagine these things happening at Hayslip in sight of her aunt. At the thought of all this splendor, Hetty got up from her chair, and in doing so caught the little red-framed glass with the edge of her scarf, so that it fell with a bang on the floor, but she was too eagerly occupied with her vision to care about picking it up, and after a momentary start, began to pace with a pigeon-like stateliness backwards and forwards along her room, in her colored stays and colored skirt, and the old black lace scarf round her shoulders, and the great glass earrings in her ears. How pretty the little puss looks in that odd dress! It would be the easiest folly in the world to fall in love with her. There is such a sweet baby-like roundness about her face and figure. The delicate dark rings of hair lie so charmingly about her ears and neck. Her great dark eyes with their long eyelashes touch one so strangely, as if an imprisoned frisky sprite looked out of them. Ah, what a prize the man gets who wins a sweet bride like Hetty! How the men envy him who come to the wedding breakfast, and see her hanging on his arm in her white lace and orange blossoms. The dear, young, round, soft, flexible thing! Her heart must be just as soft, her temper just as free from angles, her character just as pliant. If anything ever goes wrong, it must be the husband's fault there. He can make her what he likes, that is plain. And the lover himself thinks so too. The little darling is so fond of him, her little vanities are so bewitching, he wouldn't consent to her being a bit wiser. Those kitten-like glances and movements are just what one wants to make one's hearth a paradise. Every man under such circumstances is conscious of being a great physiognomist. Nature, he knows, has a language of her own, which he uses with strict veracity, and he considers himself an adept in the language. Nature has written out his bride's character for him in those exquisite lines of cheek and lip and chin, in those eyelids delicate as petals, in those long lashes curled like the stamen of a flower, in the dark liquid depths of those wonderful eyes. How she will dote on her children! She is almost a child herself, and the little pink round things will hang about her like florets round the central flower. And the husband will look on, smiling benignly, able, whenever he chooses, to withdraw into the sanctuary of his wisdom, towards which his sweet wife will look reverently, and never lift the curtain. It is a marriage such as they made in the golden age, when the men were all wise and majestic, and the women all lovely and loving. It was very much in this way that our friend Adam Bede thought about Hetty, only he put his thoughts in two different words. If ever she behaved with cold vanity towards him, he said to himself, it is only because she doesn't love me well enough, and he was sure that her love, whenever she gave it, would be the most precious thing a man could possess on earth. Before you despise Adam as deficient in penetration, pray ask yourself, if you were ever predisposed to believe evil of any pretty woman, if you ever could, without hard head-breaking demonstration, believe evil of the one supremely pretty woman who has bewitched you. No. People who love downy peaches are apt not to think of the stone, and sometimes jar their teeth terribly against it. Arthur Donnithorne, too, had the same sort of notion about Hetty, so far as he had thought of her nature of all. He felt sure she was a dear, affectionate, good little thing. The man who awakes the wondering, tremulous passion of a young girl always thinks her affectionate, and if he chances to look forward to future years, probably imagines himself being virtuously tender to her, because the poor thing is so clingingly fond of him. God made these dear women so, and it is a convenient arrangement in case of sickness. After all, I believe the wisest of us must be beguiled in this way sometimes, and must think both better and worse of people than they deserve. Nature has her language, and she is not unveracious, but we don't know all the intricacies of her syntax just yet, and in a hasty reading we may happen to extract the very opposite of her real meaning. Long dark eyelashes, now what can be more exquisite? I find it impossible not to expect some depth of soul behind a deep gray eye with a long dark eyelash, in spite of an experience which has shown me that they may go along with deceit, peculation, and stupidity. But if, in the reaction of disgust, I have betakened myself to a fishy eye, there has been a surprising similarity of result. One begins to suspect at length that there is no direct correlation between eyelashes and morals, or else, that the eyelashes express the disposition of the fair one's grandmother, which is on the whole less important to us. No eyelashes could be more beautiful than Hetty's, and now, while she walks with her pigeon-like stateliness along the room, and looks down on her shoulders beordered by the old black lace, the dark fringe shows to perfection on her pink cheek. They are but dim ill-defined pictures, that are narrow bit of an imagination, can make of the future, but of every picture she is the central figure in fine clothes. Captain Donnithorne is very close to her, putting his arm round her, perhaps kissing her, and everybody else is admiring and envying her, especially Mary Birch, whose new print dress looks very contemptible by the side of Hetty's resplendent toilette. Does any sweet or sad memory mingle with this dream of the future, any loving thought of her second parents, of the children as he had helped to tend, of any youthful companion, any pet animal, any relic of her own childhood even? Not one. There are some plants that have hardly any roots. You may tear them from their native nook of rock or wall, and just lay them over your ornamental flower pot, and they blossom none the worse. Hetty could have cast all her past life behind her, and never cared to be reminded of it again. I think as he had no feeling at all towards the old house, and did not like the Jacob's ladder, and the long row of hollyhocks in the garden better than other flowers perhaps not so well. It was wonderful how little she seemed to care about waiting on her uncle, who had been a good father to her. She hardly ever remembered to reach him his pipe at the right time without being told, unless a visitor happened to be there, who would have a better opportunity of seeing her as she walked across the hearth. Hetty did not understand how anybody could be very fond of middle-aged people. And as for those tiresome children, Marty, and Tommy and Toddy, they had been the very nuisance of her life, as bad as buzzing insects that will come teasing you on a hot day, when you want to be quiet. Marty, the eldest, was a baby when she first came to the farm, for the children born before him had died, and so Eddie had had them all three, one after the other, toddling by her side in the meadow, or playing about her on wet days in the half-empty rooms of the large old house. The boys were out of hand now, but Toddy was still a day-long plague, worse than either of the others had been, because there was more fuss made about her. And there was no end to the making and mending of clothes. Hetty would have been glad to hear that she should never see a child again. They were worse than the nasty little lambs that the shepherd was always bringing in to be taken special care of in lambing time, for the lambs were got rid of sooner or later. As for the young chickens and turkeys, Hetty would have hated the very word hatching if her aunt had not bribed her to attend to the young poultry by promising her the proceeds of one out of every brood. The round downy chicks peeping out from under their mother's wing never touched Hetty with any pleasure. That was not the sort of prettiness she cared about, but she did care about the prettiness of the new things she would buy for herself at Treddleston Fair with the money they fetched. And yet she looked so dimpled, so charming, as she stooped down to put the soaked bread under the hen coop, that you must have been a very acute personage indeed to suspect her of that hardness. Molly, the housemaid, with a turn-up nose and a protuberant jaw, was really a tender-hearted girl, and, as Mrs. Poyser said, a jewel to look after the poultry. But her stolid face showed nothing of this maternal delight, any more than a brown earthenware pitcher will show the light of the lamp within it. It is generally a feminine eye that first detects the moral deficiencies hidden under the ear deceit of beauty, so it is not surprising that Mrs. Poyser, with her keenness and abundant opportunity for observation, should have formed a tolerably fair estimate of what might be expected from Eddie in the way of feeling, and in moments of indignation as he had sometimes spoken with great openness on the subject to her husband. She's no better than a peacock, as ut strut about on the wall, and spread its tail when the sun shone, if all the folks I the parish was dying. There's nothing seems to give her a turn ith inside, not even when we thought Toddy had tumbled into the pit. To think, oh, that dear cherub! And we found her why her little shoes stuck i the mud, and crying fit to break her heart by the far horse pit. But Hetty never minded it, I could see, though she's been at the nussin' o' the child ever since it was a babby. It's my belief her heart's as hard as a pebble. Nay, nay, said Mr. Poyser, thee mustn't judge Hetty too hard. Them young gels are like the unripe grain, they'll make good meal by and by, but they're squashy as yet. Feetsy Hetty LL be all, right when she's got a good husband and children of her own. I don't want to be hard upo the gel. She's got cliver fingers of her own, and can be useful enough when she likes, and I should miss her why the butter, for she's got a cool hand. And let me what may, I'd strive to do my part by a niece o' yours, and that I've done, for I've taught her everything as belongs to a house, and I've told her her duty often enough, though, God knows, I've no breath to spare, and that catchin' pain comes on dreadful by times. Why, them three gels in the house I'd need have twice the strength to keep 'em up to their work. It's like having roast meat at three fires. As soon as you've basted one, another's. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.